Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years, signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see
600,000 deducted.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. He said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you're going to jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out to Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back.
What's up, guys? This is Alex Martin, and this is the Content Creator Podcast, where I stimulate your mind and show you how to market your grind. And today, we're going to stimulate your mind.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Okay, today we're going to, this is just an introductory audio podcast, because next week is Fannie Lou Hamer week. So for those of you who don't know who Fannie Lou Hamer was, and today's podcast is titled Fannie Lou Hamer, and that Hamer is spelled H-A-M-E-R. Fannie Lou Hamer Pig Bank. She was born on October 6, 1917. Her sunrise and sunset was March 14, 1977. And I'm going off of Wikipedia here. Was an American voting and women's rights activist, community organizer, and leader in the civil rights movement. She was vice chair of the Freedom Democratic Party, and she represented the 1964 Democratic National Convention. Hamer also organized the Mississippi Freedom Summer, along with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC. She was also co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus, an organization created to recruit, train, and support women of all races who wish to seek election to government office. She was born in Montgomery County, Mississippi, and she lives in Mount Bayou, Mississippi. She was just 59 years of age. And let's see. She began her civil rights activism in 1962. Okay. All right. She was born Fannie Lou Townsend on October 6, 1970, in Montgomery County, Mississippi. She was the last of 20 children of Luella and James Lee Townsend. Man, that's a big family. In 1919, the Townsends moved to Ruleville, Mississippi, to work as sharecroppers on W.D. Marlowe's plantation. From age six, Hamer picked cotton with her family. During the winters of 1924 and 1930, she attended a one-room school provided for the sharecroppers' children up between picking seasons. Hamer loved reading and excelled in spelling bees and reciting poetry, but at age 12, she had to leave school to help support her aging parent. By age 12, she would pick up to 200 to 300 pounds of cotton on a daily basis while living with polio. Hamer continued to develop her reading and interpretation skills in Bible study at a church. In later years, Lawrence Garriott admired her ability to connect with biblical exhortations for the liberation of the struggle of the civil rights. Anytime she wanted to move in and out of any of her frames of reference. In 1944, after the plantation owner discovered her literacy, she was selected as its time and record keeper. The following year, she married Perry Pap Hamer, a tractor driver from the Marlowe Plantation, and they remained there for the next 18 years. Fannie Lou Hamer states here, "We had little money, but we took care of her and we raised her. She was sickly too when I got her, suffered from malnutrition. Then she got run over by a car and her leg was broken. So she's only in fourth grade right now." Hamer and her husband wanted very much to start their own family, but in 1961, a white doctor subjected Hamer to a hysterectomy without her consent while she was undergoing surgery to remove a uterine tumor. Forced sterilization was a common method of population control in Mississippi that targeted poor African-American women. Members of the black community called for a procedure of Mississippi appendectomy. The Hamers later raised two girls they adopted, eventually adopting two more. All right, so they adopted a total of four children. One, Dorothy Jean, died age 22 of internal hemorrhaging as she was denied admission to a local hospital because of her mother's activism. Hamer became interested in the civil rights movement in the 1950s. She heard leaders of a local movement speak at an annual regional Council of Negro Leadership conference in Mount Bayou, Mississippi, which is a historical black town, by the way. Attendees of the yearly conference discussed black voting rights and civil rights issues black communities in the area face. She became a good RCNL TR Howard. military. Oh, man, wait a minute. I'm trying to multitask here, but it won't let me do it. Okay. Well, let's see. Next week, we're going to do a whole thing on this. In 1964, let's see if I can get that. Okay. Oh, here we go. All right. In 1964, Hamer unsuccessfully ran for a seat in the United States Senate. He continued to work on other projects, including grassroots level Head Start programs and the Martin Luther King Jr.'s Poor People Campaign. With the help of Julius Lester and Mary Varia, she published her autobiography in 1967. She was tired of all this beating, and there was so much hate. Only God has kept the Negroes sane. Let's see. Okay, Hamer sought equality across all aspects of society. In Hamer's view, African Americans were not technically free until they can afford the same opportunities as whites, including those in the agricultural industry. Sharecropping was the most common form of post-slavery activity and income in the South. The New Deal era expanded so that many blacks were physically and economically displaced due to the various projects appearing around the country. Hamer did not wish to have blacks be dependent on any group for any longer, so she wanted to give them a voice through an agricultural movement. Hamer was a staunch opponent of abortion, calling it legalized murder in a 1969 speech at the White House and describing her position in terms of her Christian faith. Okay, let's see. Okay. Hamer made it her mission to make land more accessible to African Americans. To do this, she started a small pig bank starting with a donation from the NCNW of 5 boars and 50 gilts. Through the pig bank, a family could care for a pregnant female pig until it bore its offspring. Subsequently, they would raise the piglets and use them for food and financial gain. Within 5 years, thousands of pigs were available for breeding. Hamer used the success of the pig bank to begin fundraising for the Maine Farming Corporation. She was able to convince then-editor the Harvard Crimson, James Fallows, to write an article that advocated for the donations to the FFC. Eventually, the FFC raised about $8,000, which enabled Hamer to purchase 40 acres of land previously owned by a black farmer who could no longer afford to occupy the land. The land became the Freedom Farm. The farm had three main objectives: to establish an agricultural organization that could supplement the nutritional needs of America's most disenfranchised people, provide acceptable housing development, to create entrepreneurial business incubator that would provide resources to new companies, retaining those who with limited education with manual labor experience. Okay, so that's just a short introduction to Fannie Lou Hamer and the pig bank concept. We're going to spend Monday through Friday, all of next week on Fannie Lou Hamer and the pig bank concept and agricultural ventures, because that's our business plan. She had the business plan. It worked. We're just going to follow it. So on that note, where we at, everyone have a great rest of the day and terrific and safe weekend.
At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking car off business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.